This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. We critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena to better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I was in India recently, and while there I got a chance to talk to some intellectuals to explore some of my own favorite topics, one of them being psychoanalysis. And for this episode, I have with me Anurag Mishra. He runs Psychoanalysis India, or rather is one of the key movers of Psychoanalysis India. And we get to chat a little bit about the organization and how it places itself within the broader tradition of Indian psychoanalysis and what the challenges of doing psychoanalysis in the modern world might be. Good evening. I am talking to you from the Office of Psychoanalysis India with its founder, Dr. Anurag Mishra. He is not to be confused with the founder of Psychoanalysis in India, which is a longer story. But Psychoanalysis India is relatively new, established in 2013, and it's gotten, a few events out. There was a talk last week on the legacy of Freud during the week of his birthday, and other things coming up as well, plays and so forth. So before we get into details, perhaps you can introduce the listeners to the organization, what it stands for, and what it aims to do.
So Psychoanalysis India is an organization which I founded in 2013. It originated in an accident. I was driving a car and I had an accident in which my car was totaled. So for the next few weeks, I had a taxi and I sat behind, a very analytical. And when all people who sit behind, whether the couch or the driver, you have enough free time to think of all kinds of mischief. So one of the thoughts which I had was to let me contact all the people I have not had a chat with in a long time. So I got started talking with them and a conference was born. And that conference took on a life of its own. So now it is going to be in its fifth year. And out of the conference, Psychoanalysis India as an organization of independent psychoanalysts, by independent I mean psychoanalysts who are not affiliated to the university or terribly interested in the political organization of psychoanalysis in the Indian Psychoanalytical Society, but who are more interested in extending psychoanalysis to other disciplines or indisciplines, as the case may be, whether it is the interaction of psychoanalysis with technology or literature or art or medicine, whichever direction their fancy takes them, or anthropology, or political science, Marxism, feminism, wherever. So it is at the intersection of psychoanalysis with various other disciplines that Psychoanalysis India is situated.
Why did this idea compel you? I mean, there was already established an Indian Psychoanalytic Society or association that was from the 1920s even. So why did you need a separate channel to do these things rather than just build on the already existing discourse?
I think institutions have their own life, but it is to provide a home for, you know, the gypsies of the mind and of other things as well, I guess, of the heart too, that Psychoanalysis India was founded, that it is... My belief is that knowledge should be, whether it is knowledge in terms of content or in terms of practice, should be accessible and available to all. Now, that is often not the case with psychoanalysis in the university, because it is open to academics or to students, professors and such likes, or to the Psychoanalytical Society and Association, where it is open to people who are variously labeled as affiliates and students. But what of the vast number of people who are interested in the mind? I mean, most of them, the vast majority of them, will never join a psychoanalytic course, etc. But psychoanalysis is a practice, and it's also a culture. It's not just a profession or even a vocation. This is to celebrate psychoanalysis, you know, in its everyday manifestness.
What's the current state of psychoanalysis more broadly? I mean, one impasse that you mentioned is that it's stuck, it sounds like, in the academia, that it's not flourishing with other discourses, and that it's insulated itself from the public. But what about its relationship to psychology more broadly? Is it welcome there, or does it carry certain stigma? How is it viewed in India in relation to medical practice or clinical psychology?
Psychoanalysis had a strange history in India. You know, in some aspects, it almost resembles Christianity. That it was Christianity came to India before it came to the West. Since psychoanalysis came to India, or India came to psychoanalysis in 1921, or even before that, when Girindra Shekhar Bose formulated his own hypothesis of the mind, which were very similar to those of Freud and then corresponded with him. He was the only other analyst, as far as I know, who was certified as an analyst without undergoing a personal analysis other than Freud. Psychoanalysis in India started off in Calcutta and stayed there for a long time, other than a small branch in Bombay. And then a small movement started in Delhi, which was headed by, among other people, Sudhir Kakkar, who started analyzing people. And gradually and very slowly, this movement took force. In the 2002-2004, we started a Center of Psychoanalytic Studies in Delhi University, which then morphed into the Center for Psychotherapy and, you know, Clinical Research in Ambedkar University in Delhi, which is now a rather biggish institute with students from undergraduate to PhD levels. Now, coming to the question of psychoanalysis in India, as you know, it is not psychoanalysis in India. It is not Indian psychoanalysis. It's just psychoanalysis India. It is psychoanalysis as it manifests, mutates, morphs, and interacts with all varieties of local culture and, you know, the human beings which make up India, and what happens to both of them in the process.
Can you describe then the kinds of things that has happened in the process, right? Because India presents its own unique sets of challenges that Western psychoanalysis might not even have thought about, right? So what's that interaction been that makes it uniquely Indian, that morphing that you described?
I think one of the biggest challenges that psychoanalysis confronted when it came to India was that it was seen as a colonial import. So the indigenous practitioners of psychiatry, on the other hand, also practiced a Western form of medicine, but who had a kind of split that as long as they were practicing medicine, it was something technical. But when they were practicing or thinking about psychoanalysis, there was a huge resistance because it tended to question or interpret cultural, you know, ways of being in ways which were not indigenous. So it was often rejected because of that. And so it stayed on as a rather small movement, often confined to, you know, the small psychoanalytic society of India or to literary departments, etc. Because psychoanalysis refused to adapt to the terroir, this is a term that I'm rather fond of, to the terroir of India and, you know, tried to be psychoanalysis as it is in Europe or in America, that it failed to actually, you know, take root. My own belief is that as any, you know, plant or any discipline travels to another soil, another terroir, it has to adapt to that terroir and to adapt to the special, you know, to the kind of minerals present there to be able to absorb them to produce a wine of terroir. Otherwise, you know, you're producing Coca-Cola, whether it is Coca-Cola or psychoanalysis, it is not of much value.
So where would the problem manifest itself? Is it, say, in the application of the Oedipus complex, or is it in the structures, id, ego, superego? At what point do you think the Western approach is very, very limited? Because, you know, it seems to me that the fact that it's even traveled here says something about some of its key insights, right? But you mentioned something about not merely appending psychoanalysis to obscure the Indian uniqueness, right? So perhaps maybe there's some conceptual examples that you can say, like where certain modifications have to be made to extend its relevance to India.
I think the understanding of psychoanalysis, which is of the human psyche, which psychoanalysis extends, you know, for example, that there is something unconscious, that we all have unconscious processes which motivate us, which, you know, move us. That's, I think, universal. That we draw our wellsprings, you know, from desire and from aggression, from sexuality. That's important. But, you know, a lot of the rest of it is culturally variable. For example, if you look at the content, you know, the way a human being envisioned in psychoanalysis in the West is a very different human being than the one which is envisioned in India. For example, the Western man or the Western human being is more encapsulated, more individuated, more separated from other people, including his family. Whereas the Indian person is more embedded in relationships, in family, in the particular context in which he or she finds, you know, himself or herself in. Similarly, there are very many differences in the way the psyche evolves. For example, the Indian Oedipus is more like what in India is called the Ganesha complex, where the son tries to replicate or duplicate the father rather than kill him or her, and is much closer, you know, to the mother than in the West. So the forms of practice also need to be looked at differently. The Indian patient demands a far closer relationship, a far warmer relationship, a greater degree of fusion with his analyst than the Western patient does. If you try and, transpose, you know, Western psychoanalytic knowledge or even ways of practice to India, it will become a rather elitist practice with people who are already westernized to a large extent and will not address the vast majority of people who live in the country.
This brings me to the question of transmission, right? Psychoanalysis has branched out to various schools. What's been the most, I guess, compelling or adaptable line of thought out of the many? I mean, Kleinian, Winnicott, or, you know, is there a different way to think about how knowledge from the West comes here before it's modified? So I guess what I'm wondering is the canon itself, right? To what extent is it essential, or has local Indian psychoanalysis provided sufficient counterweight to that at this point?
Well, when one looks at transmission, one often thinks of an infection, and canons often fire things. So I would rather not think of psychoanalysis as a infectious cannonball which is fired into India. The fact of the matter is that Indian psychoanalysis has developed off and on a richness of its own, whether in the analysts who have, you know, developed here, like Gurindra Shekhar Bose, or the analysts who have been inspired by India, like Bion. I would venture to say that Bionian psychoanalysis is actually a psychoanalytic interpretation of Buddhist and Hindu philosophical thought. It is very, very similar to that, and Bion himself admitted to that in his life. I remember when I was a bit younger, I met André Green, who was a prominent French psychoanalyst who's now no more. And I asked him this question: how do we teach psychoanalysis? Let's say, how do we teach psychoanalysis in India? And he looked at me with a rather mischievous look in his eyes, and he said, psychoanalysis can't be taught. And I was a bit puzzled, but I somehow got the gist of what he was saying. And I replied to him that, of course, you're right. Psychoanalysis cannot be taught. It has to be grown. You have to be like a vigneron, you know, a person who grows grapes to produce wine. That you have to know the grapes, You have to know the soil. You have to know where and how to plant it with great care. But you also must be true to the terroir, to the soil. You should not try to produce a Burgundy or a Bordeaux in India. In India, we must produce Indian wine.
My sense is that because the infrastructure here for training hasn't been as developed as in the West, a lot of psychoanalysts, Indian psychoanalysts, arrive to psychoanalysis rather belatedly or indirectly. So what's been the story of that growing, right? Has it been, because I'm thinking that at least from the encounters that I've met, you know, at least over the weekend, that, you know, a lot of people were interested from different backgrounds, right? They would stumble upon psychoanalysis through a reading, through a word of mouth before they arrive to it. And I think, in a way, that's a virtue, right? Because you're not really just funneled into it in one way. So what are some of the, I guess, the general background of psychoanalysts here in India? I mean, were they homegrown from the localized institutions, or are they bringing it from training abroad? How would you characterize that growth?
It's a bit like a supermarket. You know, in a supermarket, you have all kinds of products, you know, Western imports, local products, you know, some mixture of both, some multinational companies. And so I think psychoanalysts in India are very much like that. Some are multinationals, some are homegrown products, some are a mixture. And I think you're absolutely right about it being a virtue to stumble upon psychoanalysis. As you know, when you stumble upon something, first of all, you get hurt. You stub your toe against it and shout, ouch! And that hurts. But, you know, if you manage to look down and see, maybe you hurt your toe on something valuable. And if you can see the value in that, then you forget your hurt and, you know, put the stone in your back pocket. And even if it is a bit heavy, you know, you carry it home and show it to your family members and say, hey, look, what a beautiful thing I saw. And then they say, that's a dirty stone, throw it away. But you know that it's a beautiful thing and you carry it around and you treasure it and you keep at it, you store your letters under it. And sometimes those letters that you store under that piece of stone, they are valuable letters.
You've been listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, talking to Dr. Anurag Mishra, a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst with Psychoanalysis India. And we're going to take a break for now. And after this, we'll continue in the second part of the show for more on the current situation of psychoanalysis in India and its future. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. And as mentioned in the previous part of the show, we are in India this week to talk to Dr. Anurag Mishra of Psychoanalysis India. And we begin the second part of the show with some thoughts on Sudhir Kakkar, an iconic thinker and psychoanalyst in India, and its contributions to the field and discourse there.
You've mentioned Sudhir Kakkar, who is, I guess, the first Indian psychoanalyst I've ever heard of, you know, before even knowing or even thinking about psychoanalysis in India. And then from Googling around, I realized that it's quite a vibrant discourse here. What was his contribution to it all?
Sudhir Kakkar, I think I can trace myself as an indirect descendant of him. Whether he would like to claim me as one or not, I do not know. Sudhir Kakkar had association with Erik Erikson, and thus was trained in that way of thinking about a person as belonging to a particular history, to a particular culture, to a particular time. Now, this is a very Hindu thought, actually, that nobody can escape their country, their times, their place, that a person's thinking comes from where he is located in Desh, which is country, in, you know, Kal, and, you know, who he is as a person. The only relatively small contribution that I made to psychoanalysis so far has been the concept of importing the concept of terroir from wine to psychoanalysis. And I think that is my slight extension of Sudhir's vast work. Sudhir was the person who, in fact, was the originator, if I'm not mistaken, of the, you know, word like transcultural psychology and transcultural psychoanalysis. He was the pioneer in this field to see how culture and psychoanalysis kind of imbricate with each other. And hence that psychoanalysis cannot be imported, you know, like a toothpaste into another country to, you know, clean its teeth. That it is something which has to be grown and cultured here, keeping in mind the cultural products of this country and, you know, having a relationship with them and to grow out of them rather than to, you know, be like a scientist with a microscope examining various cultural products and finding bacteria.
What does it mean to be embedded then? I mean, you've mentioned terroir a lot. One word that I'm fond of is milieu. And you've talked about psychoanalysis having to be relevant. It shouldn't be elitist. To what extent then should it be interventionist politically? I mean, insofar as it must situate the subjects in a particular class, in a particular discourse of identity. And here I have in mind the right words shift that we're seeing in India, you know, the growth of militancy in certain grassroots movements like RSS. I mean, should psychoanalysis in India care at all, or does it take a step back for a certain dispassionate standpoint?
Both. Psychoanalysis is about taking a dispassionate as well as an engaged stance towards people, towards society, towards culture. The difference between milieu and terroir is that milieu refers only to the current times, the current political and cultural environment, whereas terroir is a far broader word. In fact, I would say it's a post-human concept. The terroir refers not only to the current times, but to the entirety of places, history, geography, culture, its plants, its animals, its weather, its minerals. It refers to everything. That we do not look at human beings as being separate from their environment, that they are as much a product of their environment as they impact that environment. Similarly, psychoanalysis should be a product of India and should also impact what's going on. So we are concerned about what's going on. We do try to do what we can by not allowing our minds to be destroyed by the violence and disturbances around, to be able to continue to articulate our thoughts in both a compassionate as well as, you know, an articulate manner.
Where do you draw the line, though? Because I understand that you're trying to be a broad church, but does orthodoxy come into play at all? Does it get to a point where you might have to say this person is not doing psychoanalysis? Because from the outside, psychoanalysis can be quite cultish, right? So this person's of that school, this person has to be kicked out, this person has to be reintegrated, so on and so forth. I understand that your deployment of the term terroir is to broaden the scope of what counts as analyzable, right? Or what should fall under analysis, right? But do you take interest at all in questions of, you know, orthodoxy?
I think the difference between a church and a village temple is that, you know, church usually has one variety of God, whereas a village temple has a cafeteria choice of gods to choose from. And not only can you choose from any one of them, you can choose to go in, you can choose to stay out, you can choose to bow down outside, or you may just choose to ignore it altogether. Now, of course, India, like every other country, has its association, has its society, and so on. But Psychoanalysis India aspires to be a village temple by the side of a pond in which fish and turtles play, and which you can come and watch the pond at sunset, or you can feed the turtles, or you may go inside and pray, or just sit and gossip outside. We think that psychoanalysis lies in all of these activities.
So among other things that Psychoanalysis India takes interest in is technology as well. I think you mentioned one of the intersections that you're looking into. I think, in fact, as I walked into your office before the interview, you had a Skype session. So where does that come in, the new wave of communication and how Psychoanalysis India might respond to it?
I think every kind of technology raises very fundamental questions, whether it is pen and paper or whether it is Skype or whether it is Facebook, etc. I think the fundamental question for me that technology raises is not that of effectiveness or of privacy. I think it raises a far more fundamental question. I think the question that it raises is that what is a human being? What is a person? You know, if you, I'm wearing spectacles, the spectacle is mine, but is not me. If I'm wearing contact lenses, that distinction is still there. But what if I've had a cataract operation and there's a lens in my eye? It's a foreign object implanted in me, but I rather think of it as me. Similarly, when we send our thoughts out into the world, you know, whether on Facebook or on email or some such thing, are we extending ourselves into the outer world, or are those thoughts now not us and thus, you know, somebody else's, or just out in the human, post-human domain? I think the question the technology raises is that where is the boundary of a human being? Is it that where your skin ends that you end, or something else? My own sense is that the post-human world as we see it developing and gathering shape is very close to Indian philosophical ideas, which were expressed by Bion as well in Bionian psychoanalysis, of seeing the person as both constituted by and constituting his terroir. So I think technology is bringing ancient questions back to us. But when we look at the question of, let's say, Skype analysis, there are many people who have an opinion about it. In fact, every analyst has an opinion about it, whether they know anything about technology or not, mostly not. But like anything, it has its good and not so good aspects. You do not have the body of the person in the same room, so you're not able to, you know, be in communication with that body. Because when we are with another person, we communicate with our entire bodies, with our smells, with, you know, various other aspects. So that is definitely a con. But what can be a pro is that there are some people who are actually easier to treat on Skype than in person. For example, people who are violent, people who are prone to, you know, decompensation, can be difficult to treat on Skype on one hand, but on the other, it may be easier to treat them as well. So these are things which should be talked about and articulated, and we should have a more nuanced discussion about it rather than an outright rejection. Technology makes psychoanalysis more accessible to those places in the world where there are no analysts, that you can do analysis and supervision and transmit ways of being and knowledge over thousands of kilometers. You don't have to pay expensive fees to analysts from one part of the world to come and transpose themselves in another part and, you know, conduct analysis for long years till they breed another generation of analysts.
Can you describe a difference? Maybe, I mean, my understanding is like one is supposed to encounter the unconscious in an analysis, right? There must be a difference between how, as an analyst, you detect that via Skype and how you would in person. So maybe can you give us a comparative picture of how the two might work differently?
I'll have to think about that, but I'll just tell you off the top of my head, of my mind. I think as long as the person is articulate, you know, you can allow the person's words and sentences to enter your own mind and, you know, dream of what the person might be thinking or feeling. Now, the question of the body is there, that you cannot smell the person. You cannot really see all the person often. That their physical presence, their height, their weight, and so on, is not something you directly access. Secondly, on Skype, often you have the problem that you see yourself on the screen. So there is a question of the analyst's own narcissism in this, that every now and then you see yourself, your eyes going to yourself. And that, I think, is a difference that not many people have talked about, that you see yourself, or rather your mirror image, transposed onto the analysand. And that is a conversation which is waiting to happen. as well. I mean, there can be a huge number of ways in which the unconscious manifests in technology, you know, in the ways in which people position their cameras, how they keep it. Sometimes when they choose to say that the internet connection is bad, and so on and so forth.
You've mentioned the post-human a lot. And to me, at least instinctively, this might present some tensions with psychoanalysis, which is in many ways humanist, right? So where do you find the convergences there and divergences?
I think one of the first introductions of psychoanalysis to the post-human world was this very concept of terroir, which can be preceded by milder variants like milieu or culture. But when we use terroir, we think of the entirety of the environment where the person is. That if the person is in a rather warm environment, is it absolutely necessary to have the person lie on a couch in a stuffy room? Or as Sudhir Kakkar says, how would analysis be if it were conducted under a tree? What would be the differences? You know, is it worth experimenting with? So these are some of the thoughts that I have about this. This is a vast area to be explored. And for psychoanalysis to progress, it must explore, you know, beyond the rigidly, you know, skin-bound contours of a human being that psychoanalysis had when it was founded in, you know, Vienna, that as it goes, as it travels in time and space, it will encounter, and technology, in fact, is making it encounter a different idea of what a human being is. And I think it's about time that psychoanalysis got its thinking cap on and started thinking rather than replicating the same old ways of being.
You've talked about psychoanalysis relationship across different terroirs, but what of science? Because the mental health industry, well, it has become an industry, and it has certain considerations of efficiency, you know, quantitative approach that runs contrary to the spirit of psychoanalysis, or at least maybe, you know, until it was too absorbed by that hegemony, I guess. Do you see part of indigenizing psychoanalysis also critiquing the scientific framework that's become so dominant? Is that part of the conversation as well?
I think that's again related to the way psychoanalysis has progressed. Often now, psychoanalysts are not doctors. Psychoanalysts are people from literature or from psychology or from other disciplines. So, you know, there are many people in this, many different kinds of people in this temple, and they see things in their own different way. I don't think anything which is quantitative is, you know, kind of separate from psychoanalysis. For example, psychoanalysis is very fixated on so many sessions a week. If it is not so many sessions a week, it's not psychoanalysis, it's psychotherapy. So many minutes per hour, you know, psychoanalytic hour is 45 minutes or 50 minutes. But, you know, just try going to 51 minutes or 46 minutes. And, you know, psychoanalysts will very firmly say, your time is up. So it's not that we are anti-quantitative. It's that a lot of psychoanalysts are not trained in quantitative ways of looking at things. So it depends on who the person is. If a, you know, mathematician who happens to become a psychoanalyst, he might look at things in a different way.
All this made me curious about your arrival to psychoanalysis as well. I understand that you have a background in psychiatry and now you're a practicing psychoanalyst. How did your discovery happen?
I think my discovery happened while I was studying psychiatry in Ahmedabad. There was an institute of psychoanalysis there. And I think somewhere I was looking for something, for want of a better word, juicier than psychiatry, something more human, something more emotional. And I found it in the Psychoanalytic Institute. So I would spend my mornings and afternoons in the psychiatry hospital and the evenings and sometimes the nights at the Psychoanalytic Institute. I kind of absorbed psychoanalysis in a dream state because I would be so tired after my night duties in psychiatry that I would often go to sleep while the psychoanalytic people were discussing this, that, and the other. So I suspect I heard most of my psychoanalysis when I was asleep.
Now, is it just one thing out of your broader toolkit, or do you feel that it anchors your entire approach?
I think it definitely anchors me as a person. That among the other things, the most basic thing that psychoanalysis has taught me is that whatever I do has to have a core value. And the core value, which I look for in other people as well, especially people whom I work with, is love. That if something is not done with love, it is often futile. So one can say that it anchors me in whatever I do. Psychoanalysis is a body of knowledge. It is a way of, you know, conducting a treatment. I mean, it's also a culture, but it's also a particular stance towards life.
What makes psychoanalytic love unique, though? I mean, Christians say the same things, right? They're anchored by love. So there must be something else there going on.
I think love is love, whether it is Christian love or psychoanalytic love. I mean, you should be lucky enough to have it, and even luckier to be able to express it. In that sense, I don't find a difference between a Hindu love or a Christian love or a psychoanalytic love. But the difference, I suspect, in the psychoanalytic way of being is kind of binocular vision. That on the one hand, you are emotionally engaged, but on the other, you also have a more objective view of what's going on. And sometimes it leads to being cross-eyed and then you fall down. And sometimes one of your eyes shuts. But if on and off you can have this binocular vision, I think it's good enough.
One of the things that drew me to psychoanalysis was the fact that it makes more room for our deviances, right? And there is this anti-normative, I wouldn't say anti-normative, but there is this tolerance for the fact that we're not how we present ourselves, we're not totally coherent, our ego is not the master, and that there's this residue, there's different aspects of who we are that isn't caught in our, you know, narcissistic projections or imaginations, you know, and that one must be welcoming of these things, right? That being totally defensive might help you cope, but it might make life more difficult. So there is this sense that the weirder sides of you can find a place in your narrative, so on and so forth. So, I mean, what's your relationship to adaptation and normalization? You know, I feel like there's a strong sense that psychoanalysis helps adaptation. There's a strong sense in which psychoanalysis welcomes the darker side of you to speak. And how does this relate more broadly to where India stands in all of it?
You are sitting in my clinic, and as, you know, you were telling me about yourself, suddenly the ghost of past patients flashed before my eyes. When you deal with people, you know, you deal with the parts of you which are similar to them. And if you really understand them, you understand yourself and don't find them so different from you. So in that sense, that was one of the great, you know, discoveries of Freud, that, you know, strange people, crazy people are not so different from so-called normal people. Because even in normal people, we have strange and crazy parts. For example, everybody dreams. Now, that's pretty strange. You can become an elephant or fly in the air. You know, that's pretty crazy stuff, but you do it every night. And what's so different? Some people think it. Some people do strange things. Some people dream about it. I think it, you learn to accept the strange, or at least what your parents would have thought were strange parts of you, and thus be more accepting and loving towards other people, more or less.
So to wrap up, what's next for Psychoanalysis India? I know you have a play coming up soon. You had a conference before and a talk last week. What else is on the horizon?
I think the play, of course, is going to be very interesting. It's going to be a play based on Beyond's dreams, which I think is a fantastic way to examine or to present somebody's lives rather than who they think they are, but what they dreamt is probably closer to who they are than anything else that they say about themselves. What we would really like is to, you know, popularize internet-enabled psychoanalysis, technology-enabled psychoanalysis, to make psychoanalysis more accessible to a vast variety of people in all corners of the world, rather than to stick to a very narrow interpretation of psychoanalysis. We would like Skype, and we're going to work towards having Skype analysis and supervision accepted as valid forms of training by the International Psychoanalytical Society.
Well, thank you for your time and for sharing so generously. What would be your concluding remarks, I mean, to the listeners of this discussion? What would you like people to know about psychoanalysis in general? Any closing thoughts or messages?
Psychoanalysis is not just what happens in the clinic, on the couch. It is a way of approaching life. You can engage in that even by reading psychoanalytical work, talking about it, even listening to this talk. It is a particular stance where you connect with people around you and with other beings around you emotionally and compassionately. And yet at the same time, you're able to tell the story of that connection.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Anurag Mishra of Psychoanalysis India. Thank you for listening. Once again, we always welcome emails and thoughts from you. Please email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook. That's BFM Night School. Type that on the search space. And don't forget to download our app. Look us up on Google Play or the Apple App Store, and you can find us there. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.